Mesdames et messieurs, ladies and gentlemen, welcome.
Je suis Antonia Mayoni, directrice de l'Institut d'études canadiennes de l'Université McGill.
Me fait très grand plaisir de vous souhaiter la bienvenue à cette assise spéciale, un événement pré-conférence, comme on appelle, sur la recherche et l'enseignement en politique publique au Canada. Cet événement spécial présente en fait l'apéro, l'avant-spectacle du début de la conférence annuelle de l'Institut d'études canadiennes qui porte sur les politiques publiques au Canada.
The McGill Institute for the Study of Canada's annual conference on public policy making in Canada is being held tomorrow and this evening. And this is our pre-conference event made possible through the collaboration with Wendy Thompson, who has put together a very exciting atelier or workshop on the state of public policy making and education in Canada. This conference, and indeed I think even this workshop itself, was inspired by two things. The first is our MacBell Foundation research project here in the Faculty of Arts. It's just interdisciplinary research team that is looking at innovation and implementation in public policy, and also by a wider initiative of McGill University on public policy that is spearheaded by Madame Thompson. We're interested in the puzzle of how to understand public policy, what the drivers of change are in policymaking, and what opportunities and constraints exist for activism. And if you look at the table right behind me, you will see that we have the opportunity to examine this very question with both scholars and practitioners of public policy. And it's a real pleasure for me to introduce you to someone who can claim both roles, Dr. Wendy Thompson, professor of policy at McGill University and convener of this afternoon's distinguished panel. Before joining McGill in 2005, Dr. Thompson served at No. 10 Downing Street as Prime Minister Tony Blair's chief advisor on public service reform. And prior to that, she'd acquired considerable experience in the public sector through local government, as well as through her work with the national mental health charity Turning Point. Wendy now teaches social policy and is affiliated with several research institutes at McGill University, as well as remaining active advising governments on governance in Africa, Europe, and the Middle East. Mesdames, Messieurs, la parole Wendy Thompson.
Merci, Antonia. Thank you very much. You know you've been on this earth quite a long time when all those things you think you can remember doing. So thanks for the very kind introduction. This session was really intended to be a little bit informal, really a chance for us to be a little bit introspective, thinking ourselves as the academy, as people interested in ideas, interested in research, interested in evidence. You know, what can we claim by way of capacity to contribute to public policy in Canada and perhaps more broadly? So you know, this is not so much the depository of learned, well-researched evidence that you'll get today, but really the informed wise thoughts, perhaps, of people who are engaged in public policy research, think tanks, but people who've also been engaged in government. So I hope also there'll be time for people from the audience to have a chance to make comments and questions before our session is over this morning. So the format is consistent with this very flexible and informal approach, which is really asking Bruce Thorne and Sharon Manson-Singer, both names are used, Manson-Singer, both well-regarded experts in the field, to make some opening statements about what they feel is the capacity of research and education here in Canada and their contribution to public policy. And then we have some very distinguished commentators who will react quite spontaneously. It's not in the detailed rehearsals of the particular event, so they'll respond just from their own considerable experience and wisdom of, you know, how these ideas fit them and what else they'd like to comment on as far as this issue goes. And I think it is important for the university, for the academy, to take seriously its role in public policy. There may have been a time, perhaps in the distant past, you know, where the freedom of the university, the independence of the academy, was felt to be in some way incompatible with its engagement, scholarly engagement, perhaps, with really tough, immediate issues facing society. But I think those days are gone, really. I think we now realize that most people engaged in research and scholarship within the university really feel the responsibility, the interest, the commitment to contribute to some of the most pressing policy issues of the day. I know from my time in both government and academia that this relationship isn't always as perhaps completely tightly aligned as it might be, but I think there's no lack of goodwill on both sides. So this slightly introspective session that we're going to have now is really just geared to explore, you know, how that relationship looks in Canada and whether, to some extent, research and education up to the task of the modern policy challenge. That's by way of context. I'm not going to say any more than that, other than to very briefly and no more by name really introduce our speakers. And invite them to, you know, their few thoughts on this issue of capacity, you know, how well equipped are we to address the equality challenge. We're very lucky to benefit from the Max Bell research review taking place on the same week as the conference, so we've invited people, expert examiners, who also contribute thoughts here. So I'm going to ask Bruce Dorn, who's probably most well known for his book on how Ottawa spends, which has become a sort of classic, I guess, in its own time. Many here were familiar with it. You know, well placed by having spent a lot of time in the UK as well as here in Canada, give us a perspective on what our capacity is in Canada.
Thank you very much. It's a great to be here. I must tell you, it's the first time I've appeared under my name, which is Distinguished Research Professor. And I may wonder where that came from, and I just have to tell you that the two alternatives presented to me were retired old fart and war veteran of some kind. So I picked Distinguished Research Professor. This reminds me actually immediately, you know, 10-minute time limit, of the need to aware of the org chart with respect to brevity and argument. The first one is that an assistant professor is somebody who has a point and turns it into a lecture. An associate professor who's somebody who has a point, presumably based on research, and turns it into a course. And a full professor is somebody who has a point and turns it into a career. A dean is somebody who's forgotten the point. And who knows what a distinguished research professor does in that hierarchy. But I am, to show how heroic a task I set for myself, I'm going to try to make 3 points. And they each deal, or the deal in turn, with all the research at universities, as the first arena, in a sense, some observations about an argument, I guess, about government departments and agencies, including labs, science and technology labs, and then finally some points about the nature and the realities of doing policy research and the kind of volume of policy research that's now out there. So on policy research at universities, I guess the central argument I'd make, and then see if this comes up discussion, is that universities still are probably the least likely to only see the government as their audience for policy research. They're more likely to ask the question about what their policy research is for, and therefore it may well be aimed more at students, or its future people involved in this work, or who maybe end up working for interest groups or just working in different ways in the community. So their interests are not always and are only focused on what they deliver to governments, and I think that's actually quite important. When you actually look at the field of public policy, there still are some core schools of public policy, so there's one would expect strength there. I think that's a much stronger area than, for example, when I started in this field. But there's an awful lot of other kinds of public research done in other departments, foreign policy departments, departments of international affairs, some excellent individual people and core staff in energy policy, tax policy, and so on. So when you actually look at the areas, there are a number of capacities there. When I compare with my experience in the UK, one of the things that's obvious is, that, or at least to me, is that there are far fewer schools of public policy in the UK, but many more established research centres that, in fact, deal with public policy. And that's because their granting bodies have funded centres more generously, and they become bigger, have a bigger scale than in Canada. And that's an issue I was raised in the context of universities. There is the issue of scale and critical mass and kind of continuity of work, because policy analysis doesn't just require kind of spectacular announcements and lobbying, but just good, steady, solid research on issues that maybe do not have an audience, only than they, but will have in due course. The other thing, and this one point, is to understand in research terms and policy research terms, there's been a significant change in the last 20 years, 15 years, of actually calling a lot of policy research on governance. And this has a dual implication. If we're not actually calling it public policy, but in fact are looking at some broader concept, which is quite valid, actually, then it may be that less policy research being done by universities in that context and more tied in behind broad ones of governance, which includes other broader issues like interest groups and other players. So that's all by way of universities. Now, let me just talk a bit about government departments and agencies, because this is all tied in. The argument I want to make here is that the state's own needs for its own independent search has never been needed and has never been weaker, in my estimation. And I stress this because the government, and I stress the word state, the state is over the government of the state, all the agencies of the state, the courts, parliament, and so on. And its research needs cannot always be supplied by private actors, interest groups, academics. The reason is that a lot of that research often will never arrive on time, in a timely way for what ministers and senior officials actually need. So the state has to have this kind of extra capacity. And some of this was gained in the mid-90s with the program review, with the big budget cuts. And there's some of it's been replaced, but a lot of it hasn't. It's just been left in my view, weakened state. This applies not only to normal policy analysis backed by social science, but also policy, particularly in regulatory areas, where you need science and technology in government laboratories, feeding in on a regular basis and on a timely basis. Governments do need outside advice. I'm not arguing that, but they do need some minimum capacity in-house, or they can't actually be good recipients of policy analysis. Now, the final point is on the nature of the relationships and the realities of policy. And here, I just want to establish, at least argue for a benchmark here, which some of you may take as a bit pessimistic, but mostly I'm an optimist. And that is that when you think of actual policy research coming into governance, the odds are that most of it will not be accepted, used, or implemented. Because if it was, we would have 10 times the taxation, 10 times the spending, and 10 times regulation. So governments are always figuring out ways to say no politely. And they say no often. They don't like to say no. They may often just say, see you next year, or come back with further ideas. But that does set some kind of an ultimate limit on how much advice. And I want to relate this to the question of the volume of advice coming in, good and bad, because the nature of academic of the research that's now entering governments through various routes, directly into ministers, via interest groups, via think tanks, via community groups, and so on, is that a lot of this literature is now consists of both normal academic literature and so-called gray literature. The gray literature is often also peer-reviewed, but not necessarily peer-reviewed in the same way that academic literature is. So the question of evidence then comes up. But the volume of gray literature coming in is extremely large. It's partly what the Internet delivers. It's partly what international agencies and policy advisory bodies deliver. And the sheer volume of it is now so large that that's another factor in terms of how policymakers interpret this. And, of course, the Internet is the other issue that's changed overwhelmingly in terms of certainly in my lifetime, the experience of doing research. So I think in public policy terms, the role of the university has to be understood in terms of its core role. This means it is not always capable of delivering things on time because it's got another job. And that is a traditional job, but I've listened to a lot of debates in Canada in recent years about the R&D and so on, and they need to have more research to be commercialized in universities. But there are a lot of people who have been involved in commercialized research who, in fact, argue that the university's best contribution to commercialization is to produce good graduates, not to produce necessarily patented material that then feeds into the policy process. So that's it. I think universities have their role, and I think it's grown. The state has its own needs. These have been weakened, but they have never been greater, not only in current crisis, in lots of other circumstances where it just isn't arriving in a timely way. And finally, the notion that the nature and reality of policy research is changing massively, and that there are inherent limits to how much people in the center can actually absorb, even under the best of wills. So, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Bruce. There's I think a lot of lead-ins that I know we'll want to pick up in the questions about, you know, just prodding a little bit more on how you know some of the Canadian universities would match up to some of those challenges and how developing. But we'll move on and now ask Sharon Anthony-Singer, who's very well placed to contribute to such a debate, this having probably been one of the few people to have spent time both in government as well as in the academy and university, but now president of the Canadian Policy Research Network. I guess it wouldn't be wrong calling it a think tank, I guess. So it has research aims as well. It's combined with the role of a think tank. So Sharon will take 10 minutes and, again, give us some thoughts on capacity to do this kind of research and thinking here.
Great. Thank you very much, Wendy. I'm going to use PowerPoint because that's the definition of an accident. They come from out of town and they have a PowerPoint. So, you know, that's what we did. I'd like to do really three things, just like Bruce. First of all, I'm going to talk about CPRN and a research model because we are research-based and evidence-based think tank, and we don't think that that's mixed message at all. I want to talk, too, about the policy research model and an assessment of it and how it is. Finally, talking about Canada's policy capacity and what that means for joined-up government and what the kind of things that we need to do in order to good advice to ministers, first ministers, and prime ministers about what's going on. So let me just start by telling you a little bit about CPRN's research. CPRN's the leading socioeconomic think tank in Canada, measured by internet hits, and certainly one of the most influential, along with my colleague Mel from the Institute of Research on Public Policy. And I like to think of it as a four-legged table, being the first leg of the table is an academic, peer-reviewed, high-level, high-quality research. Now, I can say as a former academic, for the most part, that's completely and totally useless to any politicians or decision-makers because it's ununderstandable. So we take advantage of the second leg of the table, which is to translate that into policy options, making it really accessible to the bureaucrat politicians who need to really understand what this means from a public policy context. And I think that for the most part, most think tanks in Canada are really at that level. There's a first step and a second step. But what distinguishes our institution from others, I think, is really the process we use of deliberative dialogue or citizen engagement. And I think that the point that we've made earlier around the kind of evidence we have, we can all see that there's a triumph of evidence in many areas in public policy, and we have stacks and stacks and stacks of evidence. But let me tell you that a very bad advice for meeting to a minister, first minister, prime minister, walk down this short plank of evidence, minister, but by the way, the Canadian public neither values it nor understands it or wants it. In other words, there's no demand for this. You know, if his or her colleagues don't cut him off the knees, certainly the first minister will. So that citizen engagement, the prospect of finding the kind of values that are necessary to understand really what Canadians value in public policy terms means that we have the opportunity to really talk about what it is that Canadians value and want. In other words, where's the demand? And last but not least, we have a very broad dissemination through our website, and we have over 2.5 million downloads of our work every year. And I do have some more work on deliberative dialogue. I'm not going to say too much about this right now. What I am going to do is I'm going to show you the next slide, which is called Don't Try This at Home. And I have a few copies of it, so if somebody wants to take them, I've got some for you. If I can just offer those, as Don't Try This at Home. This is what a friend of mine, Everett Lindquist, by amalgamating three or more slides into one piece. And this evidence comes from a paper that will soon be published and is the site of a roundtable on policy alignment and policy capacity by Everett Lindquist, and it'll soon be published on our website. We also had the opportunity to have a roundtable with clerks and or members of the clerk's office from across Canada asking the question, do we have what it takes to give good policy advice in these changing times? And that took place and will be reported on very soon. But when you look at this, a number of actors, including think tanks that are here and producers' knowledge, you understand that the public policy making process has a great deal of work that is going on in it. It's not solely related to education, nor is it related to just think tanks or the other places that are there, but the receivers, the bookers, all, and the knowledge producers, and definitely the investors, all make a huge difference in terms of the outcome and the public policy arena that's there. But what a policy framework doesn't do is really talk about some of the nuances that are there. You know, the kind of prevailing currents, the weather systems, what's going on and how it's going on in our country, and what's going on between all of the islands, sort of like the juice that makes everything flow. And so there's a lot of loosely coupled linkages. You know, we might meet in an airport lounge, or Wendy and I are chatting about something else, or this morning, for example, I had the opportunity to review a paper and we could see the other place where that paper can go and relate to pieces of work. So there's a sort of, you know, non-planned or going through or collective wisdom that is shared in non-institutional ways. And so that, I think, takes a certain amount of slack or capacity or relationships that are there. And as we see our organizations, not only in think tanks but education, as well as in within the organizational units of policy analysis, there is not anymore that kind of organizational slack that allows you to do the water conversations that get the ideas or spark kind of innovations. We have some examples of new kinds of architecture which are going out and trying to do that. For example, in the Myers Building, and today is another good example where we come together and have the opportunity to have a conversation. But that kind of slack, that kind of opportunity to make those connections, I think is very much missing. I think when you take that kind of notion, you have to look at the idea of funding policy research, and if you put it into investment terms, you might want to think about it more like venture capital. And if you don't think about it as venture capital, you know, then it's really become something where you think you're going to get hit every time. We don't get a hit every time with policy research investment, but few investments do produce good, great results and make big difference at the time when they're needed. So we have to have that kind of investment structure that's there, which is constantly ensuring that you have the good policy framework to do that. I don't think that it's done in a single narrow way or within a single place. It has to be at a meso level in terms of the policy capacity overall, where we're hooking together these different units and different pieces and bringing those pieces together. Like Bruce, I would say that the state of policy capacity in Canada is very weak overall. We had aggressive weakening of our policy shot in all levels of provincial governments across the country. There are a few provinces that we do punch above their weight, notably some in the middle, but that's happened since the 1990s, and I know I was part of it and looked at it, and that has had a deleterious effect. There's been a reduction in the capacity within the federal government overall, not just in some policy shops, but everywhere, and that has had a very deleterious effect. I think. We have cost recovery. I'm just giving an example now of Stats Can. You know, their cost recovery in terms of getting free service, the data that are so important to understanding what's happening in our country now limits that kind of use. We have had a great growth of university centers and institutions, but generally they're small and they don't demonstrate the kind of mass or capacity that are necessary. And they're targeted at narrow interests. We don't have anybody who are now being whole government advice and really thinking about things from a whole government perspective. Our think tanks in Canada are in a fragile state, I would say. We relied either on endowments or on federal funding, which now, you know, have taken a hit both in terms of the endowments and foundation, as well as federal funding has dried up for a majority of think tanks in our country. We look very different in this country compared to OECD and our friends and neighbors to the south in terms of the U.S. And I think that, you know, when you start to evaluate the state of Canadian think tanks in Canada, we're weak at the knees and we're not doing ourselves any good service. So that brings me to the question of, you know, do we have the right stuff? If we're going to be giving critical advice in these critical and challenging times, we need to have the sort of integrative and horizontal capacity to analyze and develop and to enact good policy advice. And what we have, I think, now is when we're talking about joined-up policymaking, it has to come at this point from the leaders of our government. Gordon Brown has been an excellent example in terms of his thinking around some of the financial crisis and how it can be used jointly to deal with health inequities and climate change, as well as with the financial issues. But that kind of holistic approach that integrates issues and delivers cross-government solutions and cross-sector solutions is sorely lacking, I think, overall. When you think about barriers to this kind of joined-up policymaking, I mean, in lots of ways, our current Westminster model, you know, is in many regards anathema to this horizontal or joined-up approach. Because when you think of, you know, the responsibility of ministers and or deputy ministers, and certainly first ministers and prime ministers, it's the legislation. Which comes across, you know, and lists a list of responsibilities. And, you know, those are defined legislation in terms of departments or ministers. And then, you know, your budgets are defined on the base of your legislation. And the accountability structures now are overwhelmingly narrowly defined. And budgets are audited according to the legislative responsibilities. So where are they then in terms of the accountability around joint policymaking? Where is the integrative, interdisciplinary, and whole approach to what's needed to really deal with some of these very wicked problems that we're facing right now? So I think that, you know, the point here for me is that these problems are not going to be solved by new policy solutions, and that means that we need a new class, if you like, of policy mechanisms in order to deal with it. I would argue that the collaborative approach is going to be very necessary in terms of what's there. You know, the paradigm that I came from as a policy educator, as a policy teacher, producer, decision maker, was really a social justice paradigm. And that social justice paradigm really has two levers. You know, it's tax and expenditures. And it's some combination of the two that we've pushed and pulled and manipulated and tossed together over the last, you know, half century or more to try to pull together a social policy system in Canada. But when you think about what the new system looks like, I think that the environmental system or the eco-justice paradigm is the next paradigm that's coming. And this eco-justice approach is not solvable by merely a tax and spend kind of approach. It has to be collaborative. Environment doesn't recognize boundaries. Environment doesn't recognize separation of peoples and places. And so that kind of place-based policy is really necessary. And like, the next thing that is so important is that this collaborative approach with our young people really demands that we get into a new kind of citizen engagement, because they certainly don't accept black box politics. So, quickly, some conclusions and suggestions. I mean, I think that granting muscles, foundations, think tanks, and universities, we've all been told that we have to do more with what we've got, and certainly there's a lot less than what we got. But have we assessed whether or not the changes in the Income Tax Act are going to substitute public processes or the public monies for, you know, the new private funds? And will that increase in brokerage give us the sufficient scope and level of policy analysis that we really need? I think that we need to have a lot more exchange, much in the way that this conference is going to do things, where we have the multiple perspectives, the politicians, the think tanks, the bureaucrats, the academic, where we can really get to understand what are the things that are different. And, you know, I towards our federal and provincial deputy ministers to begin those kind of convening functions, because it is important to bring together that kind of thing at that level so that we've got the opportunity for that vision to come across. So, last but not least, we've got a lot of problem-specific research partnerships, but I'm worried that we're losing receptor capacity in our country. If you saw a good policy, you wouldn't recognize it. And so I think that as we're trying to boost the quality of the advice that we give and the quality of the leadership that we have to take those policies forward, we have to look at more ways of increasing that kind of exchange. Thank you.
Well, I think that's opened up the buck big enough for us to manage here this afternoon. You can see the dynamism of the environment in which this debate is taking place. Much more kind of multi-sectoral, fueled by a massive explosion in the rapidity of challenges in government and the rapidity in which things are either charading us or really as knowledge are proposing themselves for solutions. So, but I'm going to ask some people who've been at this moment being asked to think about it on roles sort of outside of government, or they've been government, all of them at some point, very big roles. We're going to ask, starting off with Mel Catt, who's give his own comments and also some reaction. Mel is currently president of the Institute for Research on Public Policy. That's obviously held many roles. He was in more than I can mention, but certainly in the Privy Council and in serious roles since. So I'll ask Mel to give his reaction to these comments and the topic more generally.
Thanks, Wendy. I not having seen either of the two papers in advance, I prepared my own comments, but it turns out I apologize to everyone because you came to have some conflict and tension and differences of views, and we're all going to say the same thing. We really share this perspective that there isn't enough. I now chair a think tank. I'm president of a think tank, and we have this challenge of how to measure success. And last week with success, I had two thoughts. Okay, let me start by trying to apply that to academia. And I want to talk for a minute about the growth of schools of public policy. And this is a new development. It's really happened in the last 5 or 7 years. And the MPP, as it's called in many places, or MPA, in others, is really quite unique. The universities of Calgary, Ottawa, Carleton, Queens, which was first, actually, Simon Fraser, Toronto, University of Toronto, and Glendon College at York. And they take a disciplinary approach. And I remember when I was a graduate student, interdisciplinary meant no discipline. And now interdisciplinary genuinely means people bringing depth in their discipline to bear on tough problems. And I think that's a good thing. And so I was sort of hoping that the rector would be here and that Heather Monroe Bloom would hear me say, Mitchell should have a school of public policy. But I'll let you quit me, Wendy, when the time comes. I want to make the distinction, though, between public policy and public administration. And public administration is really where this came from, and it was about the organization of government and how government worked, but it's really gone beyond that. And I think the disciplines that people bring, and I think economics and political science are naturals here, and Bruce mentioned international affairs, social sciences are obvious. But I totally agree with Bruce's point. The physical sciences are now have a policy role of grand proportion, and we need to recognize that. And the professional faculties have a lot to contribute to public policy education, so I think it's important to look at that. I have only one failing. I was trained as an economist. And I want to bring a demand and a supply approach to this. So I want to think about the demand for ideas and the supply of ideas. And I started by talking about supply. I talked about schools of public policy. Let me turn to demand for a moment. I'll come back to supply again. What we really miss, il y a un manque de demande. Les demandeurs, les ministres, ne demandent pas, avec tout le respect que je dois aux mes collègues ici, les ministres ne demandent pas assez de preuves avant d'avancer leur pet projects. So I think the demand for evidence has to be there in ministers. And until we get that, now, there's a role for everybody in convincing ministers that they need this. And by the way, it was not ever there, just to anticipate my two colleagues' comments, when they were in government, they demanded evidence. But really, I think that is true, that there has been a decline in the demand for evidence. Parliamentarians at all levels, elected officials, have to be demanders for justification for policy, including their own. There's a wonderful, I'll give you a couple of really crucial websites that you should all visit. The first one and the most important is www.irpp.org. I would say that. The second one, though, is www.cartoonbank.com. And this is the New Yorker cartoon website. And you can do a word search, a keyword search on it. It's quite good. There's a wonderful cartoon that shows an official sitting behind us, handing his underling a sheaf of papers, and he says, "These are my policy conclusions. Go find evidence to base it on." That is unfortunately too true these days, and I don't think we want to be in that world, and we want to move away from it. NGOs are demandeurs for la preuve as well, and we need to come back to the role of civil society being the conscience of governments on having an evidence-based approach. Let me spend just a moment to talk about the nature of problems, and Sharon talked about wicked problems, and I, before having seen her paper, had the same terminology. And I want to particularly focus on a category of problems for which there are no evidence solutions. I want to talk about science. I want to identify equity and distributional questions for which there are winners and losers, and which are the most difficult to deal with. Those that have a long term, a long time horizon, things like climate change. Things for which we have no precedent and no memory. Y2K was probably no precedent. Recession and potential depression is one for which we actually have no memory. Now, Grasa Ben Bernanke, who studied the depression, I mean, that's a good thing. He actually brings knowledge and depth to it. And the fifth issue I'd identify, or category of issues, are those that are international, where you are not the master of the solution. So I want to say that education is for E cubed. And I thought I'd have an acronym here. So I think it's education has a role to play on the public, it has a role to play for practitioners, and it has a role to play for politicians. So I could have met Peter IV and say a role to play for public servants. I was going to talk about, by the way, all the problems I've identified are exacerbated with minority government and exacerbated by the nature of federation. I spent 4 years in the UK, and Bruce, you're there now. I really wish we had a unitary form of government. I'm an inveterate centralist. I've never been able to get out of that. But the fact is that the United Kingdom can solve problems that the federal government and provincial governments cannot solve. And, okay, enough. La rêve, met la rêve à côté. The question is then, let me turn to the supply side. Political parties used to play a role in doing serious policy analysis. They no longer do. Political parties and the research branches of the parties prepare ministers for question period. They don't do real policy work. Think tanks. You can't tell the players without a program. I'm very proud of IRPP because we are an independent think tank. We have two former foreign ministers on our board, Barbara McDougall and John Manley. They come from different perspectives. La directrice de Misque est aussi sur notre conseil d'administration. But the point is that we let the evidence speak, and that's really crucial. Parliament, I've talked about a bit. NGOs have a role to play as voices demanding. Academia has an important role to play. And just a quick word on the public service. Again, as my colleagues have already said, the budget cuts of the 90s led to the decapitation of the government. It cut off its thinking capacity, and that's been a total shame. Because both Bruce and I talked about science, the notion of having a national science advisor was a great idea, and I saw it work, and Wendy, you saw it work in the UK. And the national science advisor played a role of interpreting science to the public and explaining science to the Prime Minister. we just cut the position of the National Science Advisor in Ottawa. It never really taken off, but to Paul Martin's credit, he created it. I don't think he met with it, but it was a good direction. Complexity. The nature of these problems are hugely complex. They're all entwined. If you want to hear me talk about crisis and public policy, come tomorrow. I'm on a different panel then. And so in conclusion, I would just say that we need a demand for evidence in public policy terms, in doing the research. We need a cacophony of voices in public policy. And all of this should be addressed. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Mel. And, an unprompted proposal put forward by Mel from McGill, which is much welcomed as well. No doubt us further. But the point about interdisciplinarity, I think, is also well taken in the university. It's often been a charge of no dissent, I think, is changing. So good point for us to pick up. We're going to move on. We're sort of keeping to our time more or less, which is pretty challenging for a group like this. We're managing it. And we're delighted to have with us the Right Honourable Joe Clark. Who really needs no introduction to an audience such as this, but I'm going to claim him for McGill at this moment, although others could claim him as well. But at the moment, William is a professor of practice for public-private sector partnerships in the Center for Developing Area Studies, which is his current role, as far as we're concerned, despite as many of us. And invite you to say your comments, again, well-placed to make on this subject.
Well, thank you very much. Let me start without being all offensive, Mel. to two instances where, as a minister, I sought advice which the excellent public service was not able to provide, because the issues were new and complicated. One had to do with the question of nuclear-powered submarines. I chaired the cabinet committee that was dealing with that. We had very good defense advice. We were never sure about all of it, but we got what the minister and the deputy minister of national defense want us to get. The other question was when President Reagan proposed the Strategic Defense Initiative, and we had to try to figure out what this was all about. At the end of the day, we decided, I think, on the basis of the instincts, of the informed instincts of our public servants and our politicians. But the fact is that there was not a capacity to provide us with the evidence that we needed for either of those decisions. The major decision we took on the basis of inadequate evidence, we subsequently had to stand aside from, because the test of time was that we were not able to maintain the nuclear submarine policy that we had anticipated. I'm going to talk about being an expert on a lot of the things in which you're expert. I'm going to talk a little bit about to take the public education side of this. There have been references to the natural to comparisons with other countries. The U.S. has burgeoning think tanks, and they are diverse and they are more deeply endowed than is the case in Canada. European societies, interestingly, it seems to me, have a much longer established tradition of public policy debate, not just among elites or in parliaments, but in their populations. It's nourished, it's encouraged by academic research, by the publication of well-researched books, by a media which specializes in analytical research and often features letter columns, for example, of unusual clarity and eloquence. Canada does not have that tradition of public debate. Part of the reason for that may be geography and size, and I'm quite interested in the think tanks now measuring their success in the number of internet hits. That indicates the technology that may be in place. It's interesting if I can to divert to things I hope are not irrelevant. I want to tell a prairie story. In a much earlier age than this, the Winnipeg Free Press had a significant impact on the level of serious information that was absorbed in Western Canada. We forget now that vigorous circulation of publications was then the new technology, and it really did build very substantial consensus across distance. And I want also, if I can, to talk about the Charlottetown story, not the whole story of the Charlottetown Accord, but I want to remind everyone that in 1991, the six policy conferences of the constitutional reform process allowed genuine, serious, body-based debate of a critical issue. It happened for an interesting reason. The government had run out of legitimacy. We needed the legitimacy of the think tanks to carry the discussion, but it nonetheless occurred. I'm not going to get into the question of the referendum result, but I am interested in having us consider the process, which combined, one, an important issue, two, sponsorship by objective public policy organizations, three, direct participation by self-nominated citizens. One in four of the participants of those conferences did not belong to some powerful organization, but they were there as a result of self nomination, and this is critical, extensive television coverage. Canadians who weren't actually there had the opportunity to participate. So we were able, in that instance, to reach across whatever barriers it is that inhibit, whatever barriers they are, inhibit discussion. Now, two central political institutions, as others said, which should encourage public policy education in Canada, are Parliament and political parties. But each does that only exceptionally. It would be well worth having a serious discussion about the capacity of Parliament, as it is presently conceived, to stimulate or reflect serious debate. But the fact is, it doesn't do that. And it hasn't for some years, at real cost to its own authority. There are some interesting explanations as to why political parties have not played a more significant role. First, with some exceptions, public service, the excellent professional Canadian public service, has been the source of many of Canada's major policy initiatives, directly as a respected professional body whose purpose is public policy, after all, but also, interestingly, through social creations like Royal Commissions that opened the nation's eyes to a range of opportunities that were not then being considered. Second, political parties often existed, or once existed, to reconcile significant and often opposing interests and attitudes in the country. Their role is to integrate and to find common cause. That is less relevant now in a society where interest groups believe they can pursue their particular goals more effectively as independent policy advocates. And that, in turn, has been aggravated by the importation into Canada of U.S.-style lobbying, which is much less public here because, given the fact that Parliament so rarely initiates any significant policy, lobbyists, truly, you name an issue where Parliament has initiated significant policy, lobbyists have only the executive to influence. In the U.S. system, where the practice was born, you have to influence, you have to make your case to both sides of the aisle, not here. And so you don't have to do it here. The temptation is to do it quietly, privately, out of sight. Now, we have lost or misplaced the tradition of genuinely inclusive national political parties. That's a discussion for another forum, but that tradition may return in a country which clearly needs them. And if it does, in this modern age, that may mean more interest in policy. There have been exceptional circumstances where political parties played a significant role in defining the Canadian policy agenda. The most dramatic exception was the Kingston Conference of the Liberals in 1958, which charted much of the course, really a transforming course, which the Pearson government subsequently followed. The Progressive Conservative Conferences at Fredericton and Montmorency in the 60s were similarly innovative, but they had less direct impact on policy in part because while the party had modernized, in particular with regard to its view of the whole country and les deux nations, the party stayed for another decade out of office. So universities have a very big vacuum to fill. And it would be well to, and it's begun, obviously, engaged here and begun today, it would be well to examine how well that tradition is being performed. I'm not sure what kind of public support there is for that tradition. I'm not speaking here of governments. I'm speaking of a public attitude, public appetite. If there has not been a tradition in Canada of vigorous debate, then to some degree the proposals that may be coming from universities, whatever motive, will be in halls that would be entering into halls that have previously been empty. And that seems to me to be a part of the challenge that will be faced. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Joe. Very good insights into the state of things now and a bit of perspective on the past, and lots of fuel for our thoughts. We press on. We have the great honor and pleasure of having Philippe Couillard with us, who, again, probably needs no introduction to this group and is someone I will not list the many other appointments he's had, because now also one that we will claim for our own, apart from his role as former Minister of Health in Quebec. He's now Senior Fellow in Health Law at the McGill Research Group on Health and Law, a very recent appointment, joining us to play a really important role, along with one Joe Clark is also playing, of helping us get great connectivity with policy issues, which is, I think, a first start to that relationship. But Philip, over to you.
Thank you, Wendy. Good afternoon. Well, you know, I would start by telling you that even when public policy research has been part, one end of the chain leading to a decision, it's not necessarily the defining part. We'd like to think that government decisions are evidence-based, I would submit that they are rarely so. They are evidence-informed, which is different. And evidence which is presented by public policy research bodies is basically debated internally at the government as one of the elements to consider when you reach decision. Because what happens after the work has been done, the academic work has been done, depends en passant a lot on the behavior of its authors. Some of them can't resist holding a press conference and everyone about what their bright idea has just been. So then the report and they become a political animal with a life of its own. So then the political process intervenes, both internally in government, in political parties, as you said, Mr. Clark. And from what I have heard, I would say that most of the funds in political parties for research now are used to fund focus groups. It's a big thing to have a focus group business now everywhere. So the policy, the political process is internal, external, partisan, in play, comes into action, stakeholders, interest groups, the wider public opinion, and always, of course, budgetary issues, particularly when the public policy work shows that by doing this differently, you can use funds more efficiently and have some margins there. The problem is that the budgetary structures are not built to capture the efficiencies, particularly in healthcare. So even if you introduce this new technology and they tell you that if you do so, you will do less surgeries, it will cost less, in practice, you have no way of measuring the actual saving and rejecting it in the system, which is a big challenge. So, you see, again, it's always disappointing when you produce work and you see that it escapes your control and it doesn't have the utilization you wished it should have had. I always cite one example that I would say of misuse or public policy gone wrong, not by its authors, but by the use and interpretation government made of it. In the area of medical manpower planning, there was a very famous report published in 1991, which is called, was called the Bearer Standard Report. It was asked for by the Deputy Minister of Health, provincial, federal, and territorial, and was published in 12 consecutive articles in CMAG, Canadian Medical Association Journal, 53 recommendations, one of which was to reduce enrollment in medical schools by 10%, but also mixed with a wide area of other recommendations, like creating more interdisciplinary work, having foreign graduates included in the system, changing the way we pay physicians. And the authors specifically warned in their conclusion that people should cherry-pick the recommendations, because if you don't do them all, you don't have any results, and it could be even detrimental. They said that in the report. If the policymakers cherry-pick in the recommendation, it could be detrimental. So guess what happened? 4 years later, in the middle of a very deep budget crisis, the only objective was to cut costs. So what provincial governments then made, because they were in charge of the jurisdiction dealing with medical education and medical manpower and healthcare, they did reduce the number of medical school enrollments by 10%, even more here in Quebec, with none of the other accompanying measures that the report ended. So if you talk to people in healthcare today who have not read the report, this is a horrible thing. And it's actually used as an example for politicians that it may be dangerous to ask and use public policy research, because it may lead you to do horrible things. Everybody agrees that cutting in isolation the enrollment in medical schools was not a good thing, and we're still suffering today because of that, in view of the length of medical training. No one has read the report, and I feel sorry for its authors, because it's unfair the way it's been characterized. But this is exactly what happened. If you go back to the way it started by the Deputy Minister at the federal, provincial, territorial level asking for the report. Was the demand politically validated? Were all health ministers and education ministers aware that this report was being made when it was under construction? Then it was publicly announced through a series of papers open to the wide public, and then became again a political animal in its own right. So there's a significant lesson here. I would say that in my time as a health minister, I've seen public policy research not through universities, rarely through universities. There is a defiance among governments for what comes out of universities, because it tends sometimes, and it's true, we must recognize this, it tends to be ideologically painted. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not true that all these institutes and centers are politically neutral. We'd like to think that way, but this is not what happens in practice. But I've seen it coming from technology assessment units, which we have, I think, good ones in Canada and very competent ones, and same with pharmaceutical evaluation. And the key there for politicians is to stay completely away from these studies, not intervene at all in the decision-making. I get deeper into this because, as you said, Mr. Gunn, this is one of the subjects that we can spend a lot of time on. Mm-hmm. So, again, my conclusion is to remind you that, unfortunately for people who work in big policy research, your work is not the element. It's most often one of the elements. And you have to recognize that despite the fact that you may want to distance yourself from politics, you actually produce political material. And this has to be remembered, particularly the way you treat or people treat what they produce in the public arena. Mm.
It's been a very interesting comment made. Some certainly ring bells of recognition with my experience, I think, certainly in terms of the role that, that evidence plays. But maybe particularly, the, just to stir it a little bit, since we've been accused of being too nuts, I'll just sort of, you know, sort of put in a little less niceness, which is that I think government, the university, doesn't feel like the enemy, really. There's a, such a gap, certainly in my experience in the UK, as I claimed here. Quite often there is a real sense of antagonism between some elements within the universities, not all, but some elements, who, you know, feel they've got the right answer, feel politics is a nasty word, feel that, you know, they've got, you know, they've got what should be done, why isn't it being done, on the one hand, and politicians, on the other hand, thinking, you know, they don't really understand the complexity of the situation that they're facing and the affordability, political realities, etc. Sometimes the relationships can be not very nice, in my experience, and maybe that's been hinted at with some things that are said here. And the potential for it is huge, so, and that's a more positive part which we want to see, I think, here develop. So it's an opportunity for people. We've got as many experts in the audience here today we have on the panel, so this is really an opportunity for people from the floor to either you're allowed to agree, that's still permitted in scholarly debate, or disagree with what's been contributed here by the people on the panel, or questions or areas that you would like to take further. This is an opportunity for you to do so. We have a a good period of time, nearly half an hour to do that, so relax. I'm not going to drive you out of the room in a minute. Try and formulate your thoughts. But two people here with mics who will also help you get a proper way of expressing your views. So we'll invite somebody over here. If you could introduce yourself, that would be helpful. Mm-hmm. In the corner.
My name is Marc-André. I'm a PhD student for science here at McGill. My question relates to how decision makers actually make the decision in the end. And so basically when a decision maker has to decide what to do, or when he or she is exposed to a new public policy, there are two questions that can be asked. Could be, how much does it cost? How much would that change or improve the situation? And which questions asked might have an impact on which decision made. And my question is, what do you think are the consequences of which question is asked when it comes to making or deciding to implement a policy in Canada?
Is there anyone in particular you'd like to take that?
I guess former politicians would be a good start. Yeah.
Well,
I want to
talk to it. I'm a politician. Well, people here will end the proud tradition do as they like. So,
not as a former politician, as a former bureaucrat. I think you've got to recognize that a cabinet system, when it works, is intended to bring diverse views to bear on the subject. So those two questions are only two of the many questions that should be addressed. And I hope that the dollar question is going to be on the table, and that's the role of the Minister of Finance or the Treasurer or the President of the Treasury. But I want to link with you your question to Philippe's point. I'm a small Democrat, and when somebody says that decision was just political, I think that's a good thing. I mean, I think that's what politicians get elected for. And so you're quite right when you said, Philip, that this should inform the decision, but not be decisive necessarily. And therefore, that process of crafting a conclusion comes from the diverse views that have to be presented and argued.
I'd say the same thing, very much so. And it's clear, given the last couple agendas of the Harvard government, for example, that they're not necessarily evidence-based, but responding very directly to citizen demand. And I'll give you the example of the youth criminal justice approach that has been taken by this government. There is no evidence to support that solution at all. But there is a great public demand, and that, again, is responding to citizens. And, you know, from the role of a think tank or evidence producers, you know, it's our failure that we have not been to, you know, communicate the evidence to the public to negate the demand or have a demand that is, you know, based on evidence. So I think that there is a big role for citizens to play, and that, again, I think is the function of the cabinet table, is really respond to the citizen demand.
Yeah, just a couple of things. One of the British authors that actually spent time as a practitioner, Sir Geoffrey Vickers, coined the phrase that when you're looking at how people in authority might respond to a situation, they are in fact are informed of their appreciative system, which was, in his definition, a kind of a mixture of views about both means and ends. Because the other tendency about policy is to think of it as dealing with the ends, the future state of affairs you want to have. But in fact, many groups, many individuals are as concerned about how it's going to be done as opposed to where you're taken, whether you're going to clout them overhead, whether you're going to offer an incentive, whether you're going to be nice, or you're going to talk. So the means-ends thing is really tied into the question of how it's received. And also, I think I agree in terms of a cabinet, depending on how to run. And the current cabinet, I think, is certainly more civilized in terms of anything we've seen in and around the prime minister. But that may also be a function of minority government. But I think this also goes to me the question of the limits of using evidence-based decisions. No one wants non-evidence-based. And when I started seeing about 10 years ago centers being created for evidence-based policy or evidence-based this, I was wondering, what were the previous ones doing? Were they based on non-evidence? Were they making things up? Were they, you know? So you do need to want the evidence. You want causal knowledge, and you want knowledge that makes sense in practical situations. But that's not all you want. Most of this notion of appreciative system is that it's a mixture of analytical thought, but also concerns about values and how you're going to rank them in very different situations, in very particular contexts of the election cycle, whatever other shapes are. So I guess in response to your question, the answer is that there are probably never just those two questions. There may be 10. And I think the other kind of thing that happens at Vice is what kind of voice is it being given with? Is this constant pressure coming from people who are extreme manager, or is it gentler advice coming from people who are being polite as they talk to you? But if they're just involved in basketball terminology and in a full court press, and they just want political life, you will react differently to that. You may therefore avoid them, or you may have a situation where you say, well, I better listen to these folks because they're just louder than everybody else, and they're not listening to their research, just the sound of the noise and the inability to avoid it.
Maybe I could talk again, like Mr. Clark said, about our excellent service in Canada and also in the provincial jurisdictions. You have to realize that they really read the public policy papers. They see what is made of them. The chain of evaluation of appropriation that starts very low in the hierarchy of public service up to the Privy Council in Ottawa or Premier's office in the province. And basically what you end up reading is a three-page memo summarizing what is around the decision you have participated in. Rarely the evidence itself. So here you open yourself to a risk of the process being flawed, as was shown in the previous example of ICE. It reminds me of the very interesting historical figure, Talleyrand, a very interesting person who survived the French Revolution and Napoleon and Restoration and did this life of old age after going through all this. And at one point he was fired. He was fired many times in his political career from being foreign minister. He wrote a letter to his successor. This is what you did at that time. So in the letter it says, you know, young Mr. So-and-so, your assistants are to present you with piles of documents to read before you make a decision. Please never read them. So this is a cartoonish type of description because it's a different society we're talking about here. But I don't also remember that the public policy paper, apart from the technology assessment and pharmaceutical assessment I've been talking to you a little bit earlier, I don't remember that this having been used as a determining factor or even mentioned in cabinet discussions. Honestly, what I remember also as far as initiating work, I don't remember that much myself or my colleagues initiating work prior to a decision. What has happened a few times is that we initiated work in the evaluation of the implementation of a policy, which is a very dangerous thing to do, because you say to yourself, gosh, if the show doesn't work, what am I going to say? But we did this a few times. Actually, it's good that it's done, but it's, again, not asked for and not imbricated in the process of decision making. The other thing I would finish with this is that at committees, who you ask, the question is, just by simple political analysis, without knowing the fundamentals, you can't get the answer. In most cases. Because again, these bodies are not politically neutral.
I can make two very quick points. On the question of memoranda and the version of advice that reached ministers, I think one of the most important single things I did as Canadian Foreign Minister was to request that the memoranda that finally came to the minister bore the name and telephone number of the officer who had prepared it. And I won't pretend that I called everyone every day, but I think the sense that there was a capacity for that to happen, one on the one hand, changed the quality of the memorandum, because the normal practice was to go to deputy. And I wasn't going to make a practice going around the deputy, but I also, if I wanted to know some particular information, I knew damn well the deputy wouldn't know, so I wanted to go to the person who had... that's right. On cost, just to make a point that's been made by others. There's dollar cost and there's not. Let me again use an example. In 1979, I began to see evidence-based arguments, generally from finance and international trade, as to why Canada should get up with supply management. And you couldn't argue with the evidence from that perspective. But you took it to any company, and people who came from this province or from Ontario or from elsewhere where supply management was not only a critical part of the culture, but also where a blind action with respect to supply management could have innumerable other consequences and costs, at least in Quebec, meant that no one contested the evidence except to say that it provided only a part of the context, mm-hmm. and the decision could not be taken unless we had a larger view of context.
Okay. I'll just take the liberty of saying, I think the questions that you've raised are, I would agree with what I said, really only part of the question. I think one characteristic of the government that I was working for, was a great wish to be more strategic, and to have a rebuild of strategic capacity within the civil service that had largely been cut in the previous conservative government. So, the question was always, just about cost or what would happen about this policy, but is the policy actually in line with the interests as we've analyzed them in quite detail with the future of the UK and what kind of country we want to be, how competitive we want to be, and where our overall foreign diplomatic and economic interests lie. And, you think that that would be what any leadership of a country would have wanted, but this was revolutionary. and in fact, some of the cabinet meetings where we presented some of the first strategic reviews, as we called them, of UK PLC, were very uncomfortable because people had, particularly the Labour Party, spent a long time waiting to get into office after a number of years in opposition. And they had a lot of ideas of their own. They really weren't that open to having some, pointy-headed policy wonks, they would call them, coming into their meetings with a lot of bright ideas about, an analysis of where the country really lay. And it took a number of iterations of that discussion to change, but it was, a combination of political ambitions that brought the power, the evidence about the position of the country vis-a-vis its competitors and its internal dynamics. So sometimes people bring questions to it. The government's, going to assess them both in terms of its overall ambitions, but sometimes also a little bit in terms of the answer that's made, I think hopefully increasingly so, of what they need to do as leaders of a country to make it compete successfully and survive successfully in an increasingly globalized world. So it's sometimes a positive reason why they don't take external views. Do we have that question? Obviously, made everybody want to answer, so hopefully, you want to ask or comment. Here we have someone here.
Good evening. My name is Daniel. I just have a bit of a concern. We haven't seen much discussion regarding downsides of evidence-based practice. This is pretty much pertaining to the fact that without adequate support, they can't really take place at the initial step. And just return to context of what Mr. Clark had said regarding areas of first-generation society challenges, such as the submarines. I mean, evidence-based practice is obviously excellent, but if it can't have the support and funding, how can it come about? And so it sort of creates this bind where there's anticipation that it needs the evidence-based practice, but because it's not there, it's not taking place. I don't... To whoever.
Well, it's a comment here, probably as much a question, but I don't know if anybody wants to kind of think, you've summarized all the dynamics that people have described. I think probably just getting a round of agreement here that, that sometimes if the demand hasn't been there and the answer is not ready, other decisions have to be made. I don't know if anybody wants to add any more time. Good observation. Oh, yeah, way at the back. Mic required.
Had said about he can recall government soliciting information or evidence-based information before making a decision, but often or sometimes does so after a decision, to which I'm just shocked. Can that really be right? And I think more generally, how do we as citizens or as academics try to, how do we work to change the culture in politics around the demand for more evidence-based policy? And I've heard anecdotally the culture is actually quite different in the UK, and the government people even do demand more evidence before making decisions. So I don't know if somebody can comment on that as well. Thanks.
Maybe I could just start by clarifying. I didn't say that evidence-based research is not part of the decision process. I said I've really seen government initiating a demand for that before the decision, and I've seen it a few times after. But remember that I put aside technology and pharmaceutical assessment, which is a huge part in healthcare, at least, of evidence-based research that we use all the time and we requested all the time. I'm talking about other areas of policy.
I would just make 2 points. The first was that there are Arthur Kruger, who was a deputy minister in Ottawa for a long time and recently passed away, had this wonderful line that public servants are the permanent custodians of permanent problems. And some of the problems are genuinely going enduring. And so when Mr. Clark talks about supply management question, I shouldn't tell him that in 1979 I was in the Department of Finance working on supply management. But we got rid of a $13 million subsidy program where the taxpayer was subsidizing producers in Canada and consumers abroad. And that was a major success. It was a small little part of it. But the problem continues. And so the work continues. And the evidence builds up. And what Mr. Cuillar said is absolutely right, that the responsible official, the minister may not ask for it, but the responsible official has this wonderful line, but minister. But minister is followed by, if you do that, here are the consequences. And minister may decide to go ahead with that decision, but it at least is in the full knowledge of the assessed implications. And I think that's what a good system does. And my favorite example, your youth justice example, my favorite example of a recent case was the injunction site in Vancouver, where all the evidence and the health research around the world and criminology research around the world says that crime will go down and addiction will go down if you allow for these injunction sites. And the government canceled the program. Now, that doesn't mean it was wrong, but it's what the public wanted.
Actually, sorry. Go ahead, Bruce.
Well, just in terms of the way the question was phrased, one of the things I think has been in the sort of the history of this is that there is question of evidence, and again, I would immediately you ought to caution because it is never just evidence. So if evidence is your only standard, you're already in trouble in terms of your expectations. But the other issue is that we have had a long history of how much research, policy research, including just analysis, ought to be in the prior to a policy being developed. In the front end, and how much is ex post, which is usually an evaluation of some kind. And so we have a period in the 80s where we were doing a fair amount of evaluation research because auditor generals were saying that, and it was rational, right? You were analytical at the front end, and you were analytical at the back end. But again, when you take those resources away, you can't do all that. And the question is that a lot of people also saw, perhaps ministers included, that some of that is just waste. I mean, they seem to benefit because it's hard to see it. And so I think that becomes part of this. And let me make one final thing. I really think this is a part of this picture of how analysis is being received. And I just want to extend it one step further. And that is that, of course, it's difficult for ministers to have time to read or if they're reading a very short document. But the other feature of the whole process is that a large part of policy analysis and research is not presented in writing at all. It is verbal. It is people summing up other people's summaries of other people's summary, and the minister getting into a cab, heading to the airport, or the deputy getting into a cab. And so it's very kind of synoptic, and it is a verbal world. And the other thing to appreciate about politics is that politics is intrinsically verbal among ministers as they're doing. And some politicians are more, I think, verbal than others. I mean, they always say Brian Mulroney was that he was kind of on phone and just, you know, engaged with people in that fashion. And so that, I think that adds a further dimension because it's certain kinds of evidence may be seeping through, not just through somebody's written work, but rather they get to be the person who sums up the last summary point and maybe has the last say that can become influential. But I think the full cycle needs to be appreciated in those terms.
I just wanted to pick up on the phrase, but minister, because I've been involved one way or another with 12 or 13 cabinets, close observation, very close in some cases. There's a companion phrase to but minister, that is, but prime minister. And I think this is the first time when those traditions have not been active. And I think it is a very serious problem for the country, not least with respect to what we're discussing now, because the willingness to raise uncomfortable questions and to allow uncomfortable questions is critical to taking a wide view of what options might be. And I can certainly say, and I want to pick up on Bruce's verbal point, I can certainly say that the election of France in a minister's office or around a cabinet table is one of the most absolutely valuable qualities you can have because there are always going to be some issues that are rolling down the track, and you know or you feel that they're wrong or that they're early, or that something needs to be said to stop them. And there needs to be, in any system that's going to work, an incentive to raise that question rather than to sit down and go nonverbal.
I know we don't have too much time left, so I'm just going to sort of focus the last few moments, maybe our moment, a little bit on how we develop this relationship, you know, that we've been talking about between the universities, I guess particularly, you know, the, any sources of stimulation for public policy debate. How do we connect that with those with ability to make policy, whether we've been talking to any government, although other players also are important in terms of the regional and international relationship. Because we know, if you really think about the relationships that count, that really inform each other, the people whose advice you listen to, they know each other well. You know, they have a connectivity, they understand where each other's coming from, they have the opportunities to have regular relationships. Sometimes they're even talking about, you know, the co-production of knowledge, you know, that you really only can really know things through that collaborative. Maybe this is similar to the term that they're talking about in terms of deliberative dialogue. You know, so, and even in, I know when we were shopping around, you know, for how we were going to develop the next generation of leaders who enter universities, we really wanted to get to know them. We were choosing a friend as much as we were choosing a product, you know. And I'm still new enough here in Canada that I'm going to ask you, you know, is this relationship happening? Have I just missed it? Going on where? Is there some way we can strengthen it or become, you know, a broad part of it? You know, that's, you know, that's probably a very important step towards creating this sort of knowledge and advice, verbal or otherwise, that, that maybe maybe governments and other policymakers could use. Anyway, that's my sort of, you know, if I can steer you at all. If you have a completely other question, you ask, because, you know, we are in that proud tradition. But probably could just take maybe two more, take them in a row, so that we can get finished in time, because I know we've got a very important person coming after us, even who we could be too late. So one here and then.
The question is to Sharon, but others are welcome to feed the thinking as well. When you were talking about the need to shift from the paradigm of social justice, which the two pillars of IT tax and IT services, to one where you were talking of the beneficiary being actors, we just hosted a series of think tanks, multi-stakeholders on obesity. We are getting in another series with Sir Michael Marmot on health equity. And the question is that how do you change policy mindset to really take into account more the role of catalyzing action from all those actors, be they the consumer themselves, business, or whatever, while still doing the rest of it?
I'm going to take two questions in a row so that we get them on the table and then ask people to respond to. I think there was someone over here. In the back? Okay.
The very back.
If I've gotten someone, I absolutely should do it.
Just to the point, I know we got some. Could you maybe comment briefly about how much access there is to the civil service in Canada by policy think tanks? And also a bit of a controversial point, how much access should they have to civil service? Should they have free rein to do whatever they want, or should it be limited? Thank you.
All right. Well, I'll use those last two questions. We get an opportunity for people to comment on the questions, but also have anything that they've got burning in their mind. And people did introduce themselves last time, but this is Laurette Jouvet today from the Des Hôtels Faculty Management. And you were. Right. Good. Okay. I'm going to start here. And those two questions in terms of catalyzing the multi-sectoral sort of approach, increasingly, you know, a form of government action. It's not any other format possible. And more specifically, the accessibility of the Canadian civil service.
Just quickly on this point, and this is where you come back to the differences, particularly between thinking about public policy as opposed to thinking about governance, where you're talking about private players of many types who have part of the knowledge and also whose capacity to comply is central to actually succeeding. And I think there the issue is that there's a different kind of theory of democracy that's involved here. If you have parliamentary democracy, then you have a certain view about how things ought to get done, separate from anything else. They think it's NGOs and interest groups, and it is a form of interest group liberalism, and you want that to be more central to how things get done. And then there are others, of course, who want to even more widely based participation, the direct forms of voting and so on, which has existed in some systems. So I think every time you raise an issue like that, you end up advocating potentially a different theory of democracy, and you want to elevate it up higher than the existing one, whatever the other two or three might be. The other one was the question of access. Yeah, I think there it's hard to avoid in the current context that access to the civil service to individual officials, and of course higher up you go, is, I think, is different in minority government contests. And maybe it's also different when parties who get into power have been out of power for a long time and simply don't trust the civil service, at least initially, and therefore want to restrict access, or at least control the communication that might come out of that. Because ordinarily, I think, even in let's say, the conservative government of the Mulroney era, early on there was some of that concern about controlling access to the civil service and how much you trust them, both from outside people and inside people. But then that lessened immeasurably through time because they became more comfortable in their own skin. They had formed interactions with civil service. But in terms of outside people, I think that's there's still lots of access in other ways. If you're doing research, it's certainly still possible to get access to middle level, other senior officials, to the extent that you want to do that, because in other cases that may not be the best way to get research done. But I think that it varies according to those kind of cycles of time and what access actually means in specific circumstances that you're talking about.
Okay, thanks. I'm going to come back to your question on the sort of new paradigm and what that means in terms of the policy tools that are necessary. And we've been doing a tremendous amount of work with young people. We just finished a project for Danny Williams in Newfoundland and Labrador on creating the province choice of young people. And we went through a sort of dialogue process in every nook and cranny of Newfoundland, including Lockhart and Lethbridge, Fort McMurray, and also in Ottawa. So we have been working extensively with this population and really noting, you know, what their views are and how they are talking about the Canada they want, province they want, and how they put it together. And I think that, you know, as I've talked about this sort of new collaborative approach, this citizen-based democracy, that's not the sort of direct democracy that we're talking about, but it's really fueled by this new technology and the social interaction that takes place and social activism that takes place through this next generation of young leaders who are putting together the technology to really make a difference. And a note I think is that there is a very different approach. I mean, think tanks, public servants, interest groups have all been about sort of pushing forward particular kind of ideas and pulling back reaction responses and pushing out and doing that. The sort of internet and the sort of Facebook, MySpace, Twitter, Flickr, all of those things are not about that anymore. It's not about a relationship between pushing and pulling. It's a notion of collaboration. So I no longer get on the web and push my ideas out there. I have to get out and be a participant. And so now I think of citizen as participant, and we are in a place where the new technology is going to really allow citizens to become engaged. The sort of Wikipedia approach to policy, I mean, a lot of us have been looking at the whole idea of becoming the Mozilla of public policy. You know, how do you get that citizen input? And everyday citizens, you know, are often very different in terms of response than specialized interest groups. And you know, I find that working with Canadians that were modest, that we're moderate, and that we're quite magnificent. And, you know, I'm very enthused about this opportunity to work with citizens to hear what they have to say, because I think in general, we get very good advice from our citizens. We are quite a wonderful country, and we are fundamentally different than our friends to the south and European nations. We have values that are markedly different than other places. On the issue of access, so I think that the next generation is really going to change the way in which we do policy. It's going to change the way in which we understand democracy, because definitely, this next generation will not tolerate black box politics.
I think that these are noble aspirations, and they're all wet. So I really don't think that your aspiration, Wendy, or your Sharon, is going to come to fruition. I agree with them. I want them to be. I think with your dialogue that you talked about, I said to somebody recently that there's a spectrum between complexity and simplicity, and this government thinks about simplicity. And they told me, no, there's a spectrum between complexity and ideology. And if you're ideological, you're not interested in dialogue. So I'll leave that with you. On the issue of access, though, Joe mentioned Charlottetown. At the time, I was involved in negotiating the division of powers, and when I called you Mr. Sir. And
those were the days.
Yeah. And but the IRPP organized one of those events in Halifax that you spoke of, where the public was genuinely engaged. I was in the government at the time. I think the objective I've set for myself at IRPP is to plug us in. The research is going on. We've been doing research for years, and it's been really, really good. And it's not partisan, and let the research speak. But we can't just let the research speak. We have to give it voice. And so I think keying in is really crucial in this. And so on the 24th of March in Ottawa, we had a session with a panel on the economy and the budget, where we had senior officials of the Department of Finance, the Chief of Staff, Mr. Flaherty, in the room, MPs and senators, among senior other officials. And that was the objective, was to get our last issues of policy options to them. And I'll just end by saying that I don't believe it's as easy as it used to be. And I agree with Bruce that it's happening, and there's a lot of public service that are very open. But in the post-Gomery world, after the FAA was the Federal Administration Act, it now is the Federal Accountability Act. Access is much more restrained than it's ever been.
I fear that our political institutions, basically, not to speak yet to those internationally, are in much more trouble than we think they are. I think many of them just don't work. And to pick up Mel's last comment, attempts that were remodifications, whatever their motivation, have often had the impact of making them work less well. But our political parties don't work. Let me be relative about this. Our political parties don't work as well as they did. Our parliament doesn't work as well as it did. A wide range of instances don't work as well as they did. And that is at a time when, for various reasons, the country is bubbling more with ideas and with options and with trends that, if we could find a way to capture them, would make things better. There's also a reality about our world. It's a world where, this is particularly true internationally. There's a wonderful book by General Welch, now 5 or 6 years old, maybe older than that, talking about Canada, Home and World, it's called. She is a Saskatchewan Rhodes Scholar teaching now in Oxford. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful book, except that there's an underlying theme there that if you're as engaged and smart a Canadian as Jennifer is, you can change the world all by yourself. Well, we can't. We live in an institutional world. The great ideas can be generated outside that institution, but institutions make things work. And so, if our institutions are weakening, if their capacity to identify and integrate and act on the bubbling ideas is in decline, that's a very serious problem for us. And I think not simply with regard to the issue that brought us to the table, but more generally, that is a much more serious problem in the country than we believe, because Canadian institutions, Canadian problems occur dramatically. This is a country where the decline is by whimpers, we don't see it happening until it's happened. I speak with some very precise knowledge of Manhattan institutions that thought they had a mission and grew out of connection, out of touch with how well that mission is being performed, and that institution is now a piece of history, which no one likes to be.
Well, I would just say briefly, commenting on the public service, because when people ask me what I've liked the most in my 5 years of politics, I answer my contacts with the public service. Learn a lot from people I work with. And if it's dangerous for a government to drift away from the public or appear to drifting away from the citizens, it's advantageous if there's a disconnect between the political side and administrative side of the government. It's a recipe for bad government. And it should never be there. And the most risky period is at the start of government after a long period in position. Because you enter office with the idea that the public service is opposing you and will do everything it can to block your initiatives, which, by the way, is not true. What public service wants, I've learned with time, they want leadership like citizens. They want to be shown what the direction is and what the objectives. And they will take you there, of course, in a critical way, but they will take you there. So I leave this with you. Thank you.
Well, thank you all very much. I think we've had a good, a huge issue. I think people have contributed some pretty profound thoughts, really, about the state of our institutions, and said just now, but also the state of the public debate in Canada. The good news, I think, for universities and people who like ideas is that there's a job to do. There's a job already done in Canada that can stimulate, promote, engage, perhaps, scholarship and the community more widely in some of these discussions that may challenge some of the frailties in the domestic institutions, because they don't only have our own national and domestic issues to contend with. You know, we've hardly touched on the global nature of the world, but that is really increasingly a very, very key factor, as we've seen in the recent economic situation. We are not an island, and we rely on a form of leadership, multi-sectoral leadership, to represent the country and advance its interests and collaborations. So the job is, if anything, more challenging than it ever was. And I know that many of our colleagues around McGill really do engage passionately in some of these global issues. But perhaps we better overlook our local institutions, our national institutions, in their ability to, you know, be equipped to represent these ideas and promote them well. So good news from all those challenges just is that there's something to do, which those of us who like to do these things will be pleased to hear. And also, I think this is is part of a conversation that's already being had amongst people, in Anvil and elsewhere, about just how to best create a public policy capacity, not only just in research, but also in terms of people, which we didn't talk about so much, but a very key element. You know, we track our people in government, we find them in high places with their origins at McGill, so that's something maybe we should take more consciously as a project than we sometimes do as well. So thank you all very much. It's been a pleasure to have your contribution. Thank you all for coming. And I'm sure many of you will be staying for the next event, which I hope we finish without making Antonio too nervous. Anyway, thank you all very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Wendy. Thank you to all the panelists. If this is the appetizer, I'd really like to see the main course tomorrow. Tomorrow our course begins I'm not quite sure. The minister's running a little bit late, so it's more like 6:15 than 6. We'll have an address by the Minister of Finance, the Honorable James Freddy. And then there'll be a coffee session after that, and our conference will begin with a keynote tomorrow morning by Kevin Lynch, Clerk of the Privy Council. So thank you very much for organizing this panel, Wendy. Thank you to the panelists, and I hope you'll all mill out. We're going to do a little bit of furniture changing and stay for the minister's remarks. Thank you very much. Merci.